put it around. First of all, thank you for inviting me. It's not often anymore that I get such kinds of invitations. I usually get invited to talk about social justice things or about Franciscan life. And so that part of my life and that part of my identity as a biologist is slowly fading into the background, and the way I keep it alive in my daily life is by gardening and by taking care of the apple trees and the lemon trees that we have in our backyard at St. Elizabeth's in Oakland. And my proudest moment was that we harvested several pounds of basil that we turned into pesto on October the 3rd for our big Transitus celebration. So that's what happened to my biology background and teaching people how to farm in Texas. I think it's a wonderful example of how each of our lives, that we start off, we think we're preparing for one thing, and then God, you know, kind of twists you around and sometimes turns you upside down and so forth. And trust me, growing up in the North Beach, where part of our daily life was people like Carol Doda, like Lawrence Ferlinghetti, like Phyllis Diller. I mean, these are the people that I thought were the normal people of the world. Living in Boston, I realized life is a little different. And then it was even more different when I moved to Texas. It's just, you think when you have things, you go and do things for one reason, and then God has this kind of this subtext. And part of our task is just show up, try to stay awake, you know, and try to learn what this brick wall is that you just hit, you know. And so, because it'll reappear again no matter where you go in the world. And so I think that's part of my understanding now of my own personal ecological consciousness. My beginning, and I'm leaving off the text at this point, I just want to give you, where was the first moment of my appreciation for creation? I grew up in North Beach. We have a big house in front and three flats in back. There was no front yard. If you've ever walked around in North Beach, there's nobody has a yard, you know. And instead, we had a roof behind my bedroom. I lived in a penthouse room with my brother, and right behind our room was the roof over the main part of the house. And somebody had cut, the previous owners had cut a water tank in half and filled it with soil and put it in the corner, and that's where they had kept some flowers there. Well, I moved in 1954 when I was 7, 8 years old, and I grew up with that as kind of like my one connection with Mother Nature, was this 6-foot, you know, water tank cut in half. And I remember as a little kid planting mesembryanthemum, planting poppies there, planting different kinds of seeds there, and just watching them flower. That was it. That was my connection to nature, you know. And only much later did I discover redwood trees and other things like that. And that's partly why I went off to Davis to do my bachelor's degree, was that I realized was there's a whole other world beyond Grand Avenue and beyond Broadway and so forth. And it's like, my gosh, and it's not even paved. And so I, you know, my parents were like, why don't you want to go to Berkeley? Like, once I saw Davis, I thought, wow, I can't wait to come here for this other part of my life. And so you start one place, and then you are open to where and whatever God has before you. And we all have free will, and we all can make choices about where we live, how we live, what we decide to do. In spite of all these decisions in our lives, God sneaks in and kind of covers up these other decisions of our lives and makes them open to us as we are able to finally open our own eyes to recognize it. I think that, to use this, the example of ecology and ecological consciousness and a personal journey and this journey of faith on the care of creation, is one example in my life of how I started out with one purpose, and then consistently through my life, there's always been these other things that come through. And that when I was ready, when I was open, and when I was prepared to recognize that moment, boom, wow, wow, it's recognizing the Christ moment. It's recognizing the walking on water. That's how I see what a wow moment is. When that light bulb comes on, when you finally make the connection. Franciscans and creation is a very popular theme in today's world of global warming, of species extinctions, of the incredible drought, hurricanes that we are experiencing around the world. We've been challenged by philosophical, theological, and scientific approaches to breaking open this theme for us. We only have to watch the news, read the newspapers, to listen to the radio, to hear about all of these different ways of trying to understand and make sense of it. The most common approach to looking at this theme has been from a systematic and academic reflection and a study of, well, maybe the philosophical principles behind it. Maybe it's the theological constructs that entices you. Maybe it's the ecological theories, what scientists say about it. Or maybe it's the social, political, the economic perspective that engages your enthusiasm, your interest. Each of these perspectives give us a hint as to how our Franciscan spirituality may help us to truly understand what is the lens that is given to us from each of these different, very different perspectives. Through such a diversity of ways of understanding the truth in our lives, whatever we may call them, we are challenged to be those stewards of the gifts of the physical and the biological world that have been shared with us without any cost, without any expectation of repayment or anything. This is the free gift of God. I'd like to take this opportunity now to share with you my kind of journey and how I was able to move from one worldview, the biological, scientific, academic perspective, and then to recognize, you know, that's not the only way to look at the created world. When I first started looking at religious orders to figure out which one I should join, the first retreat I went to was a Franciscan retreat, and at the end of it I thought, well, this is the one I want to be part of. And then it dawned on me the next day after the retreat, Monday morning, I was taking a shower, and I thought, I know this is the right one, but I can't figure out why. I had no clue. I had no understanding of the vocabulary of what words I would use to tell colleagues that this is the way of life I wanted to do. So I thought, well, how would I know this is the best way? And so I spent the next year and a half visiting other orders. The Holy Cross community, which were in Austin, Texas. I visited with some diocesan communities. I visited with the Jesuit community. That was the very last community I visited with, the Jesuits. And I'll never forget, I woke up Saturday morning in the middle of a silent retreat with the Jesuits, a discernment retreat, and I realized I don't want to be a Jesuit. It was so clear to me, but it's like now I knew why. I had the words. I knew what were the questions, and therefore, more importantly, I knew what the answers were in my heart, and I was able to articulate it. So in other words, I moved from what was a very intuitive, affective decision in my mind, but this part refused to let me move ahead until it got satisfied that it knew what I was doing. And so, it took a year and a half of sorting out those questions And then the harder part was the figuring out what the inner answers were. Now, what were the words that people used to explain it? And that was my journey. That has consistently been my journey as a friar. The scientific part of me is obviously mostly up here. It's statistics. It's understanding what Linnaeus wrote. It's understanding Darwin. It's understanding big name plant physiologists. It's understanding hormone theory and so forth. It's great. There's this whole other part of understanding creation which doesn't deny this part, this intellectual part, but is a part of the sensual. It's part of the looking at the rainbow. It's looking at the stars at night. It's hugging this redwood tree that's been around for 2,000 years or more. It's being able to look at a petri dish and to look at algae that's growing on it, or to look at some fungus that's growing on it, and to recognize this has been here since the beginning of time. That is the perspective, that is the journey that I have gone through in terms of trying to connect this part with this part as it relates to the created world around us. The easiest way to describe this is, I like to think of it, I've worn glasses since I was 7 years old. So I've never known the world without glasses. So for me, the metaphor of using glasses and using lenses to understand life is a convenient one for me. And I think many of you, as I look around the room, wear glasses, and I don't know how many of you have had laser surgery or are wearing contacts, but I think you'll get the point. We frequently use a magnifying glass, right? A magnifying glass, it's one way you turn the lens, you can actually see something in great, great detail. All you have to do is to flip it over, and guess what? You see very little detail, but you see the big picture. You see, it's like taking the binoculars and turning it the other way around. You suddenly see a huge expanse that you didn't see before, and all you have to do is to flip it around. That is how it is in terms of our lives. That I came to this world, spent most of my early first 29 years working on one lens, the scientific lens of the world. And I would like to say I've spent most of my time since then, since 40 or so, working on this other lens, which is a more affective lens. It's a more sensual lens. It's a lens about colors. It's about a lens that looks at shapes. It's a lens that looks at the relationships rather than the particular detail. Our journey of life is not to focus on one or the other lens. Our journey in life is both of them. And for me, it's like this is the same person, and that most of my life now is trying to figure out how do I bring these both together. That is our journey of faith. That is the personal response to whatever new facts we might come with. Each of us usually comes with either a very affective or a very head-centered way of the world. All I'm saying is, welcome to the other side of you. Start working on what is the opposite side of you, of who you are. If you are someone that is highly sensual and very much into walks and whatever, focus on some of the detail. Focus on learning some of the facts of the ecological relationships, the hidden things that are the result of research. And if you are the highly intellectual fellow who's maybe, or a person that's gotten a degree or two in some field or loves to get a certificate and this and that and so forth, my challenge to you is go and experience a sunset. Go and experience the gaze, go to an observatory and take a tour of the skies. Go and experience what it is to walk through a state park or to walk along the beach at sunset or sunrise. Wouldn't that be nice? To try to move into that other side of who you are so that you can then begin to see There's more to life than either one or the other. Both are needed. And guess what? There's new insights that happen once that movement happens. I'm going to give one specific example where the light bulb came on for me. And then we'll go to this video, which will kind of give you less personal and a more kind of invitational model for accomplishing the same example that I'm going to give you in my own particular life. As a friar, I volunteered to do my work in teaching, and the friar said, "Oh yeah, go ahead, do that." And so they let me do that for several years. And so I got to teach at Gonzaga, and I got to teach at University of Portland. And the great part about working in these Catholic institutions is they didn't give me science majors to work with. Instead, remember, these are liberal arts colleges. They're mostly non-science majors. And so they gave me the most challenging course of all, which was to teach science to the arts majors, the humanities majors, to the English majors. And I had a wonderful time, but it also stretched me in terms as a teacher to, I no longer was teaching towards students who thought linearly, students who had wonderful backgrounds in science and mathematics. Instead, I had students that appreciated art, music, politics, economics, and so forth, and were very much people of the new world. And so I had to totally revise the way I would teach, because this the course I taught.
Accidentally pushed the button.
Okay, sorry. Okay, sorry. It accidentally hit mute. I had to change from deductive teaching styles to inductive teaching styles. For those of you that are teachers, it's how do you teach to somebody where this is not the first of 20 courses they're going to have in science, but this is their first and last science course that they will ever have. And, you know, this was a great responsibility I had to do. What I realized was that there was a very different way to teach science when the issue of the student was going to be someone that was very open-minded. One of the first examples of my own integration of learning how to do this was Keith Warner, who's a friar, younger friar than myself, is also interested in ecology. And I would usually go and accompany him on different trips, mostly out of friendship, because there's so few biologists in our order that there's only about four of us. And so I try to work to that with them and to be with them and just to encourage each other to keep our interest alive in biology. What we did was that we were in San Diego for some other meeting, and he says, "Oh, Franklin, let's go down and visit this lead recycling facility in TJ, and that there was going to be an interesting visitation that we could do there on the site." And so I said yes. I said yes because of friendship. I said yes because he was a fellow biologist. Did I have a particular interest in being in TJ? No. Did I have an interest in this as a lead recycling facility? Not particularly. So it's like, I did it because of the reasons of accompaniment, of friendship, and a fellow brother asked. So I did. Okay. That's one example of we come into life with our own intentions. What happened? We went there. This facility used to take batteries, car batteries from downtown San Diego, truck them over to TJ, melt down the core, take the pure lead, make ingots out of it, and bring it back across the border to sell for manufacturing purposes, for lead sources. hey, that's a great way to recycle, no problem with it, very ecologically sound and small footprint and everything. Well, everything was fine until there was a fire. A fire had happened at this facility and the whole facility burned down. This was part of a maquiladoras complex. So there's like hundreds of these places all doing different things, and that this particular facility was burnt down. They built the barbed wire fence around it to protect it, to keep people from coming in, because the lead was now polluted throughout that area. And so we were looking at the walking around, and there was these skull and crossbone signs everywhere on the thing. And so we walked by this trench. This trench was 10 feet long, 4 or 5 feet deep, and about 6 feet wide. And I said, well, why did they dig that? And he said, they're probably trying to sell the property, and the new buyers want to see what the soil looks like underground. Well, you looked into the trench, and there was 3 feet below the ground. The top 3 feet looked absolutely normal. From the third to the fourth foot underground was this incredibly bright white material that had already started to leach underground. This was the lead contamination that was forming and was flowing underground from the whole site. And I thought, oh my gosh, this lead is spreading. And at that point, as we were just looking at this trench, this man with a lunch pail would walk right past us. And we thought, well, where's he going? You know, and we just were oblivious to the fact that we were standing next to a trail that went down the hill. It was about 1,000 feet down. Was this? We looked over the ledge, and there was this whole village. It looked like, you know, maybe several hundred families that were living just down the hill. And he was going home for lunch. He was just walking home for lunch. And I looked around. Now, having worked with corn, I can recognize a cornfield from a mile away. And there was a cornfield right at the bottom of this hill. So obviously there was a village, groups of families that were living down there that were growing corn. They were just living their lives and working in the maquilas. They would just trudge up the trail and go home at night. So, and it dawned on me was, as I was thinking, I was walking across the property, there's part of me that was thinking, okay, about $100,000 a year, we'd have to hire 2 grad students, maybe a part-time postdoc. I gotta get in touch with the head of the organic chemistry department at University of San Diego, because I think they would want to get in on this contract to do the soil analyses and the air analyses and the water analyses to check for pollution. And this is what I used to do for a living, was to figure out how do you do remediation of a contaminated site. So my mind was clicking away, how much money it would take, who would the contacts I would need to make, how do I make this happen, how would we fix this situation. When I saw that village that was down the road, my mind totally switched. I mean, it was like a switch went on in my heart, and I realized was, where's that public health nurse? Does he or she know about this lead facility here? Where's that youth minister? Where's the pastor of this church that must be ministering to this group down there? Where's the extension farm worker that's going to help these people figure out what to do here? I realized was, as a friar now, I realized was, it's not just about science, it's not just about money, it's not just about having the technology. It's about who was going to do it, how was this going to happen, and where were the natural ways of community that would bring about the use of the technology, the use of any money, the use of any power to help alleviate the stress that they would go through. The light bulb came on. I realize now this is what it's about for me. It was not just about the scientific part, it was also now this other part that I had become very aware of, the social part, the societal part, the faith community part, of how does a faith community rise to the challenge and bring all of the technology with them, as well as their faith in the goodwill of humankind. That was my journey as a scientist who had now become a friar. That was that special moment when the light bulb came on and I realized was, I'm not just an agronomist anymore. There is a part of me that now has nurtured this whole other side of the way I look at the world. The way I look at a problem. Problems no longer are technological issues, they are also spiritual ones. And that is our journey together. Yes, I as an individual need to work on this, but guess what? Each one of you is also called. And guess what? We are called to respond as a faith community as well. But you can't jump directly into the we without first doing it for yourself. Once you do it for yourself, you then understand what it takes to call others to this journey so that we can make those leaps of faith. It is one thing for me to make a leap of faith, and only when I do that am I then able to ask anyone else to make that leap of faith. And so it's with that kind of backdrop that I want us to watch this video, and then I'll make some final comments as we kind of listen to this video.
In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness night. All the light that we have ever known is contained in a thin layer that wraps around the surface of the earth. Its mysteries challenge human comprehension. The search to understand them and their deepest meaning is at the heart of both science and religion. Some call this the creation. Some call this the biosphere. No matter what their perspective, all behold this vision of all. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures. And let birds fly above the earth, across the dome of the sky.
We relate to God through God's handiwork. Nature is God's textbook. It's God's gift to existence. So to read God, we read nature.
So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves of every kind. And every winged bird of every kind. And God said that it was good. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good.
The creation was something to be deeply valued. It's precious for all of us. And I like to say that it doesn't matter how you view the origin of the creation, you come to the same conclusion. The diversity of life that surrounds us is a gift. It's something that was bequeathed to us and it's something that we bequeath back down onto our descendants.
A great deal of uncertainty, skepticism, curiosity, as to how it would be received. But when we opened the great two-ton bronze doors of the cathedral, there were 4,000 silent people in this great sacred space. And we watched an elephant, and a llama, an eagle, a hawk, a pony. And as they all moved down the nave, the length of two football fields, people wept. And as nearly as I could understand, people were experiencing a moment of reconciliation. Churches and synagogues to open their doors more fully to life itself. Invite life in, the wonder of life, the reverence of life. It doesn't have to be an elephant or a llama coming down the nave to the altar. It just can be a sense that what's out there now belongs in here, inside our congregations and inside our hearts.
So God created humankind. Male and female, God created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth.
Human beings are clearly distinct in creation, a strange combination of the dust of the earth and the breath of God. We have a God-given creativity which we can use to improve the world and improve our lives. And at the same time, that creativity, which is our godlikeness, is constantly restricted by our creatureliness, if you will. The idea that even though we're unique in creation, there are absolute limits on human behavior and our choices of how we use God's world.
The human species, where do we fit in the great diversity of life that surrounds us? For thousands of years, the concept of dominion has been an important theme in religious thought.
The scriptural view is, dominion does not mean abusive use. It means earth keeping. It means creature keeping. If we decide to take charge, which we have as human beings on earth, then we, as good stewards of the creation, are obligated not to destroy that over which we have been given dominion. So this dominion really is service. It's the same sort of thing that's reflected in Genesis 2:15. Adam is asked to serve the garden.
And the Lord God planted the garden in Eden, in the east. And the Lord God took the man and put him into the garden of Eden to serve it and to keep it.
Adam is asked to serve the garden. That's a really interesting concept, because what comes out of that is that recognition that the garden, or the creation more broadly, serves us, serves all other creatures with the fruits of creation, but we also serve it. And so there's a kind of conservice, or a conservancy, or a conservation.
The command is a basic command. It's the first command, you know, to keep the garden and to care for it. And I think that we have to understand that. I mean, it's elemental. I mean, it's there in Genesis before you get the Ten Commandments. Caring for the creation is a fundamental call that the Lord places upon us all.
Our relationship to the earth is also a subject of profound interest to scientists.
Humanity, we were created here, we evolved here. This is our home, to which we are adapted in exquisite detail. That means that the levels of oxygen that we breathe, the humidity, the temperature, all things maintained in equilibrium, pretty steady state, by all these millions of organisms in the midst of which we live, is exactly what our bodies need. In other words, we have a superb environment, beautifully adapted to us now. We should be attempting to conserve it for our own good.
As we better understand how the biosphere protects us, we are realizing that instead of protecting it, we have been altering it at an ever-accelerating pace.
This is the first time in the history of people on Earth that we are having a tremendous impact on the entire biosphere of the Earth. We're beginning to appreciate the magnitude of that influence. Never before have we had as many people on Earth. Never before has the use of the resources, the biological resources of the planet, been as great as it is now. And the impact that we are having is absolutely astounding and, frankly, quite frightening.
We could lose as many as 20% of the species, plants and animals on Earth, particularly on the land surface where most of the damage is occurring right now, in the next 30 years or so, if we don't take stronger measures. The only way to save the rest of life is through the preservation of natural environments, habitats, reserves.
What we need is a much broader recognition of the problems that careless human activities are bringing upon us. A realization that we cannot be rescued by science and technology, because these problems at their root are human problems and have to be dealt with as such. And it's clear to the scientific community that this is the case.
Thanks to our scientific understandings, we know now what we didn't know before. We know the damage we're causing, and we know the consequences of our actions. And I think that changes the situation greatly in terms of the ethical nature of the dilemmas we're facing.
We really have to save the creation, and we have to save the planet. And we can only do that
if we feel that it is a unitary goal, that we all have something at stake here.
I think we have to look deeper in our hearts, if you like. This is a problem of values. It's not a problem of techniques or approaches or science. It's a question of values. It's a moral and ethical problem, challenge as to how we, this living generation, treats the environment that we so critically depend on.
I think that this issue, more than any other issue, has the potential to overcome race, class, gender, whatever divisions that are, you know, plaguing our society, that we can come together on this.
I think the articulation of the environmental crisis has made me think a lot more deeply about what is the biblical vision of humanity's position in the world and in the cosmos. And I think that the biblical material has a great deal to say on this subject.
And God said to Noah, "Make yourself an ark, for behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth. You shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive."
The First Endangered Species Act is where Noah is asked by the Creator to take two of every kind and preserve their lineages. And it's interesting that the cost of this Endangered Species Act is immense. Noah spends perhaps something like 100 years, immense resources, very valuable wood, a great deal of time, and then perhaps the most devastating of all to most of us would be the derision that one would get if one would spend 100 years building a very large boat on absolutely dry land. But the result is that he is the one who is faithful in preserving the species, in preserving their line, and the rest of the people perish from the earth.
Father Fon suggested, because we're going to run about 5 minutes over if we just let the video run, and we respect so much your hunger for good things, that he'd like to just say a few comments on what we've seen, and we'll break promptly at 11. And then when we come back, we'll catch the last 10 minutes of the video.
This is one of the most beautiful videos I've seen, which captures part of what the dilemma, and I don't want to say it's the problem, it's just, oh, sorry, turn it on.
It captures the dilemma. The dilemma that we face as a culture, as a society, as a people that inhabits this place we call Earth. Because no longer is it about us who live in the first world, because we're realizing it's the same Earth, regardless of which continent you live on, that the weather patterns, the way we've interconnected our economies now, there's nowhere that's not your backyard. Everywhere we are connected, and that's part of this kind of next part of our own self-awareness that has to happen, and that's, in a way, that's what's being touched upon in this video. I just want to kind of connect some dots for you so that you can make a connection in your own lives. One of the key things that I started off this talk about was to try to figure out and to explain to you what characterizes a Franciscan approach as opposed to a Dominican or a Benedictine or an Ignatian approach to this, or a Protestant approach or whatever. Our Franciscan approach is that we believe that God is present in the entire world, that God's first gospel is creation, and only later, as he thought about it, he had to come up with some words. And so we have the Bible that's the kind of really the second text of the gospel, but that the first one is read with our hearts, our eyes, our hands, and our feet. And it's about processing that information in ourselves. We as Franciscans acknowledge this and recognize that the best way to become connected to this knowledge is through accompaniment. Accompaniment. It's not through getting a doctorate. It's not through getting some certificate of study. It's not through writing a book, even. It's about accompaniment. It's about accompanying God and each other to celebrate the gift that we have received. So, accompaniment. My greatest insight came when I accompanied my brother Keith on what I thought was just a trip to spend a nice afternoon somewhere. Through that accompaniment, because I kept my eyes and my heart open, I recognized there's another agenda here. It wasn't even on my plate. I did not know it was sitting there, but because I stayed awake, I showed up, God took care of the rest. And thank God, this other person who was walking by with his lunch pail got my attention. Consistently through my life, I have done certain things for one set of reasons. And guess what? God has these other reasons that somehow slide in there, and all our task is stay awake, show up, and then when you recognize it, say, hallelujah, amen. Thank God I can recognize a miracle. Thank God I can recognize that moment of Christ's presence. As a scientist, I saw this whenever I could look at a pile of data and be able to see, this shows X, Y, Z. It was that same sense of feeling that I get now when I am with those that of a spiritual nature, that same sense, that same part of my kind of brain and feeling of making a connection, seeing an underlying principle here that is operating in the life of plants, in the life of a farm system, in the life of a village, in the life of a nation. It's being capable of recognizing those moments. And that came about because I was willing to accompany someone. It wasn't because I wanted to get a doctorate in theology. It wasn't because I wanted to go do XYZ or serve 1,000 cups of coffee somewhere or whatever. No, it was simply that I showed up for a friend. That is what this cross of San Damiano exemplifies for us and reminds us as Franciscans. It's about relationship. It's about these people that showed up even in the darkest moments of Jesus' life at the crucifixion. It's about accompaniment. And so that is what I want to leave you with, is that this video is, the subtext is about accompaniment. How do we invite two of every species into our ark? How do we invite them into our cathedrals? How do we relate to them? As pictures or as living beings that we share our sacred space with? Whether that sacred space is along the beaches, on the mountaintops, or in the beauties of cathedrals or the meeting halls of society. How do we make these connections? And so that is, that I think, the fundamental basis of our Franciscan response to the issues of the day. How do we accompany those who are dying of diseases, those who are suffering in poverty, those who cannot vote or don't want to vote, or those who have no money? That is our challenge as friars, Franciscan men and women, is how do we accompany those who don't even know that they're not around, that we're not around.
Let's give Father Fonger a round of applause.